And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Erin McGraw to the program today. Erin is a writer of fiction. Her novels are The Baby Tree, The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard, and Better Food for a Better World. She's also published 4 collections of short stories, and today we'll talk about the most recent one, Joy and 52 Other Very Short Stories, which is published by Counterpoint. Erin, the first story in the collection is America, where a teenager talks about the method style the director of her school production of West Side Story, and he wants the kids to employ this method style in prepping for the show. And I have to admit, you totally sucked me in just 4 pages.
I am delighted to hear that. That's my job. But the whole method thing is based on a true story. And when West Side Story was first being put on before the movie, I think Jerome Robbins was the one who imposed these kind of crazy rules on the cast. And the Sharks and the Jets were not allowed to mix, and they were encouraged to have as much animosity against each other as they could. And he spread rumors among the Jets about the Sharks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. And so he really tried to instill a lot of hatred in the two gangs before the show went to the stage. I've talked to actors since who, in those circles, this is a famous story, and they say, yeah, he did that, and it's totally nuts, but
we got West Side Story. Did fights break out beforehand?
No, but there was a lot of friction. At least as far as I know, fights didn't break out, but there was a lot of friction.
There are a couple of stories where we have celebrities.
Yep.
In there. We have Patsy Cline in one.
Yep.
Then we have another story narrated by Ava Gardner with mm-hmm. Frank Sinatra there. Did those stories in the West Side Story one require research that the other ones didn't, or do you research all of the stories?
I research everything, and especially if I'm getting into an area that I don't already know anything about. There's a story called Teeth that takes place in a dentist's office, and I read book after book after book to get that one down, and I just wanted to get my details right. And even then, I still had to seek out my friend who is a dental tech and get some particulars nailed down. But yeah, I did. I read the huge Frank Kaplan biography of Frank Sinatra in 2 volumes. I read everything I could find about Patsy Cline, including a biography. You want to get stuff right, and you find things out that I wouldn't have made up on my own. There is, in the Patsy Cline story, there's a little detail about her hiding $1,000 in her house in case anything went sour between her and her husband. That's true. Those were 1960s dollar bills. They meant more then.
Did you go over to North Carolina? I think there's an Ava Gardner Museum over there.
There is. I know it, and I haven't been there, and I'm dying to go. So that's on the list.
Were there any other true life stories that I didn't notice throughout the collection, or were those 3 the only ones that had those true life?
I think those are the ones. Always there are things that are kind of built on either people I know or situations I've heard about. In the story called Hope, it's narrated by a woman whose daughter has been abducted and killed. And that was based on a true crime TV show that my husband and I were watching. And the mother had this kind of ghastly smile on her face as she spoke to the camera about what had happened. And I kept thinking, why is she smiling? And that was where the story came from, trying to understand why this agonized woman was smiling.
When you get the spark of an idea,
mm-hmm.
do you know immediately if it's going to be a short story, a regular short story, or it might have legs for the novel?
Kinda. I mean, yeah, in a way. For one thing, this book has 53 of these dinky little stories in it. And after a while, after writing just one after another, I started to see the whole world in terms of these snapshots. But as a rule, if a story idea comes to me that's very episodic and is pulling in lots of characters, I know that that's one that's going to need a lot of pages. And if I think of something that kind of goes poof and explodes, that'll probably suit itself to a story.
Now, do you think there are times in the past where one of those little poof ones, you would have just said, well, that was a nice little thought, and just not done anything with it, as opposed to going and saying, okay, I'm going to write this 4-6-page story with it?
These are new for me. I've been writing a long time, and I started this book maybe 5 years ago at the most. So this is kind of a new discovery for me, and something I have not done, and was in fact something I was kind of opposed to. I got dragged into this one kicking and screaming.
Well, who dragged you into it?
Me.
So have you had a good talking to by yourself yet?
Well, I always do that. I bet I'd written 25 of these before I finally acknowledged, okay, this is a project. You're actually doing something, Aaron. Don't be silly.
And so when we hit 53, how do you know that's the right number for this book?
Yeah, people ask. I probably had written around 45, and I said, okay, it's time to sit down and read these all together and see what I've got. And that's when I saw I had some holes, and there was a certain balance that I wanted that was missing. And so I sat down and wrote stories to fill in those holes. And once that was done, I had 53 and the book was done. I didn't want to write more just to get to some arbitrary number.
When I was sitting reading the book, and it took me about two settings to read the book.
That's nice to hear.
I said, but maybe this isn't the best way to do this. And with the number being so close to 52, the number of weeks in a year, I said, maybe like a devotional once a week reading would have been a better approach.
That's kind of a horrifying thought. These are not very devotional stories.
Well, there are a number of stories where people are having crises of faith.
Yes.
And I was wondering, were you having a crisis or is this just the characters that came to you?
I think about things like that a lot. But no, I was not in any kind of spiritual crisis myself, not more than usual. So no, it was just these are issues and ideas that preoccupy me all the time.
Over 90% of the stories are told in the first person.
Yeah.
And is that because it's an easy way to get right into a story and make that connection with the reader?
Well, yes, but that's not, in fact, what got me started. The first two of these that I wrote, which were never intended to be any part of a big sequence, one of them is the story Prayer, which is first person in a way, but it's directed to a very specific you. Those were both written as assignments. People I knew were doing books, and they said, would you write a small piece? And I really liked how they came out. I liked the energy of them. At the same time, I had just finished a novel and I was tired and I didn't feel like picking up another long book. So I thought, well, those are kind of fun. I'll do some more of those. And there's a really fast-paced, hell-bent for leather energy that happens in these stories that I'm fond of and I like playing with. What they officially are, if the English major wonks will know this, is dramatic monologues. It's the moment in a play when a character steps out from the drama and directly addresses the audience to say, here's who I am, here's what's going on, according to me, here's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And I love those moments because they're so naked. They're often lies. How often do we want to justify ourselves to the whole world? And how often do we not quite tell the whole unvarnished truth?
But there is a story called Friendship,
yeah,
which is just done in dialogue.
Yeah, there is.
And instead of doing quotation marks to set off the exchange, you use the M dash. And I was wondering if there was a Joycean thing you were going for there.
That story is profoundly non-Joycean. No, it's just that if you normally I punctuate exactly by the book. But the thing about quotation marks, and now we're getting into the weeds, is that they do kind of set the speaker a little bit apart from the reader at an extra remove. And the M dash doesn't do that, which is why Joyce did it. So I wanted that extra millimeter of closeness, and so I switched the punctuation around. But that story just about killed me. It took 3 years to write.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. It was really, really hard. And I have so much more respect now for playwrights than I did before.
Do all the stories run the gamut of how long they took to to write?
Yeah, some of them took a couple of days. And then that Friendship by far was the longest and the hardest, and I threw it out, I don't know, 15 times and fished it back again and threw it away and brought it back.
Now, you talked about a lot of people lying. There's a story called Honor where we have a young man who has done a type of radical honesty in a way, but he's really lying to himself all
massively
the way through.
Yeah, he is. And that's why that story was so much fun to write. And it's so interesting. I mean, it's gruesome. It's an awful story. But the character's sense of himself as some kind of Galahad is so tremendously at odds with who he actually is that even this not very bright fellow inmate calls him on it, and he calls BS and says, come on, look at yourself.
But he was accurate in saying it was your lie that started
your
path to jail.
He was.
those characters who are so caught up in their own sense of rectitude, mm-hmm. whatever it might be,
yeah.
but have the ability to impose their will on the world are really fascinating characters.
Yes, they are.
Especially for us who are kind of sit there and vacillate between what we should do.
Again, these are dramatic monologues. They come from the world of theater. The one writer I consciously thought about when I was working on this book was Shakespeare. Not because I'm anything like Shakespeare, I'm not, but he was doing things I wanted to do. And that particular kind of character that you were just describing, the one wrapped up in his own sense of rectitude who is behaving in a horrible way, is a very Shakespearean character. That's Iago.
When I read short story collections and do interviews for them, you know, mm-hmm. I like to see what kind of themes run through several of the stories and everything like this. And with there being 53 stories in this collection, it almost seemed like data collection at a point.
I bet it did.
Did you ever worry about exhausting the reader with so many different worlds to jump into one after another?
Maybe this is not good of me, but no, it didn't. I was hoping that a reader would walk away when he or she got tired and then come back when they're ready for more. So no, that didn't concern me. What did concern me was, gosh, I'm writing a lot of stories about, say, art and the making of art, and I hope I'm not just beating a dead horse with this. And I hope I'm not. That's the best I can come out with. I think that I kept coming at it from different angles, but you know, readers are going to be the judge of that.
And it seemed music was the art form that I noticed the most in the stories. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering, you know, why music had caught your attention for so many of these.
I know a lot of musicians, and I know a little bit about the making of music, not much. So it was an easy enough place, a natural enough place for me to start. I know less about visual art, and so I figured I'd stick with what I kind of knew. And then there's no, as far as I know, there's no visual art equivalent to a rock and roll drummer. And we bring, as readers, so many assumptions to that particular role that made it really attractive and fun.
And there were a couple of stories that were tied together in the music realm by people in the story who were not proficient
yes.
at creating music.
Yes.
There's one where an older woman plays the church organ terribly.
Mm-hmm.
Another one where a son who's on the autism spectrum sings in a very out of pitch and very loud way. And I was just wondering about that, struggling with art, enjoying creating, but not being to others mm-hmm. proficient. What was interesting in that?
In both of those stories, the characters who aren't good are observed by characters who have better ears and who are positioned to say, oh, that's really bad. That's sour. That's off. That's dull. That's terrible. And so the ones who are talking are not, in those cases, the bad artists. They are audience members who really resent what they're being made to hear.
At the end of the one with the mother with the son who's yeah. on the spectrum, there's a couple of other stories in that, and where at the end of the story, kind of like the punch at the end, is where people kind of really lean into the pain of their situation. And
yeah.
I thought that was a very interesting dynamic of those stories where people just said, okay, this is painful. Just give me more of it now.
Yeah. Well, the mother is imposing a certain kind of penance on herself. She feels she has brought pain to her family, and she's not wrong about that. So she's saying, I deserve this.
But then there's the little girl in the Nutcracker story, who she really leans into it at the very end.
Well, in her case, she's wanting to punish her mom and grandma, and she's envisioning a future where the tragedy she's envisioning for herself makes her mother and grandmother say, oh, how we brought this upon ourselves. And they're really, when you're 10 or 12 years old and you're mad at your mom, there are a few things sweeter than imagining her crawling back to you for forgiveness. And that's kind of where she is.
And in that same story, Nutcracker,
mm-hmm.
the little girl does not like the Nutcracker. She thinks it's creepy.
She does.
And she's been taught in school to name danger when she sees it.
Yep.
And I think it's a really fascinating concept. My girlfriend has a daughter who's young, and I've been rewatching things from our youths,
mm-hmm.
my girlfriend and our youths, and saying, oh, wow, that's not cool at all. This
Oops.
Is really bad. Mm-hmm. And it's just this revisionism that we look at things that we saw when we were young and how they are not really copacetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, it is. It's dead interesting. But I will tell you, that story came from reading an advice column. I think it was Dear Prudy in Slate. And somebody wrote in saying that her 8-9-year-old daughter was having a fit because she didn't want to go to the Nutcracker, and Grandma had bought tickets and Grandma was disappointed. And I thought, why wouldn't a little girl want to go to the Nutcracker? Oh, and the story started.
It's Creepy McGee is what it is.
It is. Yeah, it is.
And my girlfriend's daughter, we watched Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the Rankin and Bass special. Mm-hmm. And she said, Santa's a jerk. Why would Rudolph ever want to work for him?
Oh, you go. Truth-telling child.
There's a story in which an older cruise ship musician has to control himself with a teenage girl that's on board, and he's kind of perceiving advances that may not be there. But I want to know, is the story called Job or Job?
It's called Job. He's suffering, but he's not suffering that much. And I'm going to say, I think she's flirting with him, and I think she knows pretty much what she's doing. And she probably isn't aware of just how much pain she's inflicting, but she's enjoying the power she's got.
So you're originally from Southern California, and a few of the stories are set there. How many of the stories do you think the setting geographically in the United States is an important thing?
I'd have to actually page through the table of contents, but a minor number, I think. A lot of these float in kind of America, 21st century America someplace, and the Philippines.
And they seem to be mostly set in what we could construe as contemporary settings.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, there is one that's in 1964, I believe, as Stingers.
Yes.
And
yes.
That has kind of, I think, kind of the spark of a theme that we see in a lot of the stories of that's kind of the spark of infidelity that story.
Oh, yeah.
And infidelity is in so many of the stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A handful of the stories got started by my listening to a piece of music and just thinking, I'm interested in the mood that is evoked by this. I wonder if I can do it with words. Stingers was one of those stories.
What was the music? Do you remember?
Yeah, it was a Stan Getz bossa nova. And so the timing of that was important because it's absolutely right before people started talking about women's liberation. But it was in the air. It was about to happen. You read writing from the time and you can just feel it crackling in the air. And I've gotten significant blowback on that story from young women readers who are angry at the way the men behave in that story and the way that the narrator permits these men to behave. And I think that's how it was. This is how people behave. This is an accurate portrait. We don't have to like it. And I wrote the story in such a way, I hope, to make it clear I don't approve of this. But this was what daily reality was, and our not wanting to see it that way doesn't change it.
Well, and you say, good, I'm glad you don't like it because it is not something that is to be liked.
Well, aren't you right? Yeah, that's exactly the answer I should give. But yeah, there are a lot of stories that are about infidelity, which is another place where a lot of lying happens.
When you would come upon that theme in the story, did you have to think about what angle I'm going to take on this, or did it just all flow from the characters and you could kind of see the point of view and the way it's addressed coming afterwards?
It comes from the characters. It's completely dominated by the characters. And if I have an inconvenient reaction to a situation that has nothing to do with what the character would be saying or doing, my reaction gets ashcanned because it ain't about me.
There are three sets of stories that have stories that are paired up or connected to each other in which we see one character's point of view and then another character's point of view from that story. And I'll have to say by the time we get to the third set, the kind of the bait and switch that you play on that, I just enjoyed it so much.
Oh,
it
was, I'm so glad to hear
I just
that.
Went, oh, she got me.
Good. Good.
And
I'm
so
very happy.
Was that intended?
Oh, yeah. The reality that I see on a given day will only have so much to do with the reality that my husband sees on that same day, and neither one of us will see what my dog sees. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in the parallax, and particularly because those are stories that take place at moments of emotional crisis. What the difference in what characters you're seeing is important.
Because you kind of set up this Rashomon type thing.
Yeah.
And so when we hit that third set, we have expectations and you subvert our expectations at that point. I don't want to ruin it for people, but I hope everyone is delighted, is it, when they reach that. But in doing that, you had to sequence those sets in a certain way to build that expectation. Mm-hmm. And so how was sequencing the stories overall? What was that process like? Was it different from a more traditional 12-story collection? And what was the importance in the sequencing?
It was only different in that it was harder because there's more of them. There are more moving parts to keep track of. But putting together a collection for me is always nerve-wracking, and I sit on the floor with printouts of the stories in a circle around me, and I will pick up one and say, all right, what is this? How does this start and how does it end? And then put it next to another one that doesn't have the same kind of beginning or end, and then hope that there are no echoes in the middle and get them in a provisional order and then read it through and say, oh, no, that's not going to work because this has an unfortunate repetition of this. And it takes a long time. And so you take that process and you make it much bigger. But what I was saying earlier about reading all the stories together and finding the holes, the stories you're talking about were stories I wrote to fill a hole because I thought, oh, I need one more set of pairs. The book feels weird if I don't have one more like that.
How did you decide? Because the first set is a pair of stories. The second set is a trio of stories. Mm-hmm. And then a pair, was that an attempt at symmetry or is that just the way the stories worked?
That's the way the stories worked, but I'm happy enough that it's symmetrical. But yeah, it was about the material.
There's another theme that runs through quite a few of the stories, and it's married couples, and one of the partners is infirm or in the process of facing their own mortality and dying. And I was just wondering why in particular you explored that theme.
Both of my parents died in the last 10 years, so all of the issues involved with that and with their friends, whom I wound up spending a lot of time with, those became my stories, and those became things that I was thinking about and involved with in a daily way. And there's a lot of inherently dramatic material folded into those questions. And so I write about marriage a lot. I think marriage is very, very interesting. And so I write about infidelity. I also write about couples getting together. And I write about the ends of marriages.
You're an experienced writer. And have
to my sorrow, yeah.
I hope you get some comfort from all the work you've done. But I was just wondering, do you still surprise yourself in the way stories can go and what characters can do when you put them on the page?
I don't feel like I surprise myself. I feel like the material surprises me, and that happens all the time. I couldn't keep doing it because it can get to be a very boring occupation. And if you're just listening to the sound of your own voice, it can be very boring. So I like listening hard to the material and hearing something I hadn't heard before.
Another theme that comes throughout is addiction.
Oh, yeah.
And well. it's a tough one. There's one story in particular that had a very sideways look at it, and where a woman is unhappy with her husband. And before they had gotten together, he had spent most of his life caring for his addict sister.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it had made him very kind of compliant and just to roll with the punches because he knew he couldn't control his sister's behavior. So he had to be just a person who reacted. Mm-hmm. And his wife was very upset with that passivity that he showed in that regard. Mm-hmm. And it was just a very interesting take on that subject.
I know a lot of addicts. I'm related to addicts. I'm kind of stunned that I'm not an addict. It shows me my extraordinary good fortune. And so these are issues I know very much from the outside and maybe a little bit from the inside as well. And it's heartbreaking. It's also dramatically very, very rich. And so for somebody who writes, it's material that's just waiting.
Do you think writing might be your addiction?
Oh, no, no. It's really easy for me not to write. That's super easy. No, my addictions are more like eating and walking the dogs.
So I know there's a limit to authors and how much they can kind of see in their books. And
yeah,
they place things in there that their subconscious is
absolutely right,
gigging them to do, but they aren't quite aware of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But is there anything, major themes that people have talk to you and then they just overlook these huge themes in the book and say, maybe people might want to pay attention to this while you're reading.
You, I think, might be surprised how many people that I've spoken with, at least so far, the book is really new, have just bypassed the whole issue of the creation of art, particularly the disappointed artists that I think are so thick in this book. How can you miss them? But so far, people do, and that's not what they're focusing on.
Do you think it's a disconnection that maybe they themselves aren't artists and they don't pick up on it? Or
I wonder. I do wonder. I'm not sure. There's so I have a neighbor whom I love very much in Suwanee, Tennessee, who said to me, the book is called Joy, but there's a lot of it's not very joyful. And I thought, yeah, you're right. It's not. Maybe the title is just a tad bit ironic.
Well, and the story, the title story is about a woman who takes her sister when they're children to a dog show. And then her sister passes away in a car accident. And
because she's drunk.
Those themes of losing a sibling, mm-hmm. there are quite a few of those that run through the stories as well.
That I think I just plucked because in that case, I don't remember having anything more pressing on my mind than she needs to have a loss. Well, I'm going to take her sister away from her because the fiction writer gets to be God.
And there were a couple of other stories in which you had characters, one a man and one a woman, who are taking care of their adult mm-hmm. siblings because one is morbidly obese and is homebound, and the other one is paralyzed because of his drunken behavior, his
That's
own
right.
drunken behavior, not his brother's. And you mm-hmm. have these two poor characters who aren't in touch with the rest of the world because they're so much tied up in their siblings' misery.
Yeah. In the case of the brother, he feels a lot of guilt, kind of misplaced guilt. He's not the reason that this situation exists, but nevertheless, he does. With the sister, it's weirder and more Hitchcocky, and it's this sort of whatever happened to Baby Jane scenario moved to different kinds of characters. So theirs, I think, is legit creepy.
I really like the touch of the young man she's interested in, I think Jordan was his name, mm-hmm. and that he has his own really bad background, and that's maybe why they are drawn to each other.
But, well, I mean, poor thing, she's drawn to him because he's handsome. That's not a crime. Him, I'm a little worried about. I'm afraid he's playing a deep game, but we don't get his point of view.
Yeah, but she's willing to violate all sorts of laws and stalk people through her HR position.
Yes, she is, and I think he's figured that out about her.
Ah.
See? Hitchcocky.
And that's another part why I wonder if reading the story straight through, because it didn't give me enough chance to kind of sit back and reflect on them a little bit.
I can never experience reading this book the way a new reader will, but people talk to me, and so far folks seem to be falling into two camps, the slow one story a day or one story a week reader, and the read it in one or two sittings reader. And I haven't met anybody in the middle territory who said, oh, yeah, I read it across 4 or 5, 6 days.
So when you read, how do you usually read books?
When I read a normal book, in other words, not one that is 53 very short stories.
Well, either like a traditional 12-story collection or a novel.
If I'm reading a traditional collection, it's usually one story, put it down, process, come back a little later, next story, put it down, process. A novel I will give as much to at a time as my life will permit, because generally novels are built for that kind of thing. They are built for the long, slow pace and staying with it and building on what just happened and introducing new ideas and starting to braid them together. And it tends to reward, at least in my experience, a thoughtful immersion. And if I can only dip in like a hummingbird a little at a time, I usually lose what's going on and I have to start at the beginning again.
In writing these stories, did you have to do much cutting to peel them back to the 4 to 6 page length, or they came out pretty much realized?
Well, I was writing them with this in mind. I knew that I wanted to keep them short, so that curbed me from the start. They've all been cut some. There's nothing that I wrote in perfect shape or that I wrote and then had to pad out. And partly the literary skeleton of them has to do with appreciating the stuff that goes unsaid. And so often there will be a kind of dropped thought between one sentence and another, and I'm counting on the reader to fill that in, to understand how the character went from sentence A to sentence B. And for me, there's real pleasure in being sufficiently in another character's head that I know what she's thinking right there. I know what's going on. And I hope that the reader is feeling that kind of pleasure, too.
When you were dealing with those real-life characters of the woman who is Patsy Cline's dresser mm-hmm. and Ava Gardner and Frank Sinatra, since so many readers are already going to have details in their heads about that, did you feel more freedom to kind of then stretch things and not have to fill in those gaps for people?
You know, I did with talking about Frank Sinatra. I figured I could count on readers to know some basic things about him, that he was a singer, that at one time he had girls screaming and flinging themselves at his feet. I figured, okay, you can trade on that. You don't have to fill it in. Otherwise, with both Ava Gardner and Patsy Cline, I tried to inject information as unobtrusively as I could for readers who might not know.
And I really enjoyed how Ava thought Frank was washed up when they were together.
Well, at the point in their lives where I situated that story, he was at the low point of his career. He had no recording contract. Hollywood wasn't interested in him. He thought he was washed up, and he tried to commit suicide a month later.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did. He slit his wrists.
So I guess that was before he went over to Reprise and started.
Yeah, it was well before Reprise, and it was also before From Here to Eternity, which was the movie that he got the Oscar for and that completely turned around his career. And that was his rebirth as an artist.
So when you were writing that story, did you imagine what type of toupee he was wearing at that time?
I think he was not wearing toupees yet, but he was certainly still wearing hats or already wearing hats all the time. But I think he still had his hair.
In experiencing writing these 53 short stories, mm-hmm. is it something that you've gotten out of your system, or is it something that's kind of taken a hold of you and might be something that you keep doing?
I'm still doing it. Now, I don't know if this is just the last fumes from the tank that are burning off. I got a handful of these at home that aren't in this book. And I've got an idea for a new book. It's a structural idea. I'm thinking, oh, I'd like to build it in a certain way, but I can't attach it to any idea. And if I don't have an idea, I don't have anything. So I think I'm writing these little things just to keep myself occupied until something comes along and I say, oh, I could do that.
Does theme or character spark you on a new book-length project?
Character, for sure, and situation. Theme is about the last thing I think about, and I let the theme take care of itself. So I didn't set out to write a bunch of stories about artists, a bunch of stories about God, a bunch of stories about marriage. Those all just happened.
Well, Aaron, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing Joy and 52 other stories with us today.
What a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Aaron McGraw is the author of Joy and 52 Other Very Short Stories, which is published by Counterpoint. I'm Stephen Usery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.